Could you turn, please, to 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 11, and we'll pick up where we left off last week. Peter's first letter was written very much in the context of suffering Christians. Now, there wasn't a lot about that in last week, but virtually all that we're talking about tonight has to do with Christians suffering. I want to go through the remainder of chapter 2, and then on to chapter 3 and finish at the end of chapter 3, so we have quite a bit once again to get through. From chapter 1 verse 11 through to chapter 3 verse 12 is all to do with the same topic, and that is, it has to do with Christian relationships, relationships which Christians have with people, relationships with the government, relationships with their employers, relationships in the family and in the church. Now, they are the four areas that are talked about in the major part of our talk tonight. The ground rules are laid out in verses 11 and 12. I beseech you as aliens and exiles to abstain from the passions of the flesh that wage war against your soul. Remember that we have the setting of the Christian's home being in heaven, and the Christians are spoken of as exiles, as pilgrims, as strangers, as people whose true home is in heaven and who in the world are in enemy territory. Their inheritance is in heaven, we saw last week. Here he says in verse 11, you have a war in this world because we're in the territory of the enemy, and so we have to abstain from the passions which life in this world stirs up. That's very negative, but verse 12 gives the positive aspect. We are to maintain good conduct among the Gentiles, that is, among those who don't believe, so that in case they speak against you as wrongdoers, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day of visitation. That's a reference, of course, back to things Jesus said in Matthew chapter 5, and Peter, our writer, was one of the people who heard Jesus say those things. Now that really, verse 12, that when they speak against you as wrongdoers, they may see your good deeds and glorify God, that is now developed in these four areas of relationship that I spoke about. Firstly, the Christian and the government. Verses 13 to 17. Be subject for the Lord's sake to every human institution. God wants society to be run orderly and properly, and Christians are to be cooperative. Whether it's to the emperor as supreme, or to governors as sent by him to punish those who do wrong and to praise those who do right. For it is God's will that by doing right, you should put to silence the ignorance of foolish men, and so live as free men. Yet without using your freedom as a pretext for evil, but live as servants of God. So honour all men, love the brotherhood, fear God, and honour the emperor. And the emperor, just for interest, happened to be Nero. Now Nero, as we well know, was not terribly sympathetic to Christians. And yet the Christians are told that even though this brute is persecuting them, they are to give him the respect that's due to him as the head of state. Christians here in this context were persecuted by the government, everything was going wrong, and yet they are told that in spite of all that, they are not to be stirrers, they're not to retaliate. And if they're persecuted and if they suffer, well, then they are to accept that. And if they suffer for doing right, okay. What they've got to make sure is they don't suffer for doing wrong. And if they suffer for doing wrong, well, it serves them right. He tells them to live as free men, yet without using your freedom as a pretext for evil. Sort of guiding principle that I think our society needs. Because most people, as soon as you give them freedom, they got no idea how to handle it. And they think it means do as you like. Most people cannot handle freedom. Now Christians should be the best example as to how we should handle freedom. Because this is what Christianity is all about. We're saved by grace. We're not under the law. We are free men. We have this liberty in Jesus Christ. Yet we use that freedom as men who know what the will of God is. So the instruction given in verse 16 to Christians is that they are to use their freedom correctly. So as we move around in society, we have to be examples to the people round about. So that's the first area, that even though the government may be anti-Christian, the Christian still has a duty to be obedient. Honour all men, give all men the respect due to them. Love the brotherhood means Christians in particular. He says you're to love them, which is a bit better than just honouring other people. But fear God, and so you go up the scale again. You honour all men, you love the brotherhood, and you fear God. You hold him in reverence and awe. And then you come back to just ordinary respect for the emperor, honour the emperor. From verse 18 to the end of the chapter, he then goes on to speak about servants, or if you like, slaves. Now, many slaves were Christians, and it's the Christian slaves that he talks to. Remember that he's talking to Christians all the time. So it's servants or slaves, you people in the church who are Christians, you must be submissive to your masters with all respect, as he said in the previous verse, you respect all men. Not only the kind and gentle, anybody can respect somebody who's kind to them, but even to those who are overbearing. Now, there's no doubt that the slaves got a pretty rough deal in those times, and the masters, the slave owners, treated them like dirt. And you could understand the slaves getting rather annoyed about the whole thing and wanting to retaliate. Peter says to the Christian slaves, you must be submissive. Don't retaliate. Take the example of Christ, he says. Verse 19, one is approved if, mindful of God, he endures pain while suffering unjustly. For what credit is it if when you do wrong and are beaten for it, you take it patiently? Well, there's no credit in that. But if when you do right and suffer for it and you take it patiently, then he says you have God's approval. And to this you have been called, because Christ also suffered for you. Part of the Christian's calling, he says, is to suffer as Christ did. And if you remember the Sermon on the Mount back in Matthew chapter 5, and there's no doubt that that Sermon on the Mount had a great influence on Peter, and you find references back to the teachings coming out time and again in Peter's writing. One of the great teachings in Matthew chapter 5 was that the Christian is not to retaliate, he's to turn the other cheek, to go the extra mile. To that we have been called. That is part of the Christian's calling. It's a bit hard to take sometimes. We like to get up and get stuck into those people that are doing the wrong thing by us. But he says no. The Christian has to learn to be submissive. To this end you have been called, and Christ suffered, leaving you an example. If you want to find out how you should behave yourself when people are doing the wrong thing by you, look at the example of Christ. Verse 22, he committed no sin, no guile was found on his lips. When he was reviled, he didn't revile in return. When he suffered, he did not threaten. But what he did do was to trust to him who judges justly. He had a confidence in the overruling justice of God, and he submitted himself to God's will, and he trusted that God would do his will, whatever that might be. But it was not up to him, up to Christ, to take the law into his own hands and to retaliate against those who maltreated him. We hear a lot today about rights. I've got my rights and he's got his rights, and we're all defending our rights, and people are marching up and down the street talking about their rights, and people get very touchy on this subject. And I think it's a bad thing when Christians follow suit and are always concerned with their rights, always defending their rights, demanding their rights. If there's one thing that's very clear in the New Testament, it is that the Christian is not to stand on his rights. He is to be prepared to forego those rights if necessary. Mind you, I think the Christian is to defend other people's rights. I think that's a very clear teaching of the Bible, that we're not to sit idly by when other people get trampled on. We have a social responsibility, and we are to be concerned, as Jesus was, when he saw these people trampled on by the rich, when he saw people who devoured widows' houses and for a pretense made long prayers. He didn't tolerate those sorts. And the scribes and the hypocrites and the Pharisees and these people who exploited those below them, Jesus gave them short shrift. But when it came to his own rights, you don't find him defending himself at all. Likewise, the Christian, we're to be concerned for those who suffer unjustly, but for ourselves, when we suffer unjustly, he said, submit. When Christ was reviled, he did not revile in return, but he suffered. And when he suffered, he didn't threaten, but he trusted to him who judges justly. He himself, in verse 24, bore our sins in his body on the tree. Whose sins did he bear? He bore the sins of those that he is now telling to forgive others. Our sins. The people that are now required to forgive others, Peter says, remember that we were sinners, and yet Jesus bore our sins. Can't we be forgiving to others that do wrong to us? Jesus left us an example, so that we might die to sin and live to righteousness, so that sin's power over us might be broken and this new life might blossom forth. By his wounds you have been healed. You were straying like sheep, but now you've returned to the shepherd and guardian of your souls. So there is the instruction given to the servants. Now in both these cases, you find that you have people who are being exploited by the system. And when you come to chapter 3, likewise, you find people who are exploited, and these happen to be the wives. So we have our third example. And in each case, you'll find that the basis of the instruction is submission. In verse 13, for example, submitting to the government. In verse 18, servants being submissive to their masters. And in chapter 3, verse 1, wives being submissive to their husbands. But look at the context in each case. The context is of Christians who are being ill-used by others. Christians are being ill-used by the state, but they have to submit nevertheless. Christian servants are being ill-used by their masters, but they are to submit nevertheless. And here, Christian wives are being ill-used by their non-Christian husbands. But nevertheless, says Peter, you are to submit. But notice what he's talking about. He's talking about women who are Christians and who have husbands who are not Christians and who give them a rough time. He's not talking in chapter 3 here, not in the first 6 verses anyway. He's not talking about Christian husbands and wives together. He's talking about women who became Christians after they were married, and now they are believers and their husbands remain utterly opposed. And so these poor women are getting a tough time. Now, how are they to behave when they're getting a tough time like this? Well, again, Peter says, submit. Peter is not approving of this male domination. He's not approving of this wrong treatment of wives by husbands, any more than he approves of the wrong treatment of slaves by masters or the wrong treatment of citizens by the government. But he says, even if their treatment is wrong, that's no excuse for you. You're not to retaliate. You are still to accept these things. What does he say to these women? You wives, he says, likewise, following on, there's no chapter division in the original, and it just keeps on following through. Chapter 2, verse 18, servants, be submissive. Chapter 3, verse 1, likewise, you wives, be submissive to your husbands, so that some, though they do not obey the word, may be won without a word by the behavior of their wives, when they see your reverent and chaste behavior. Verse 1 there is one of the more well-known blunders of the King James Version, where they have those who do not obey the word may be won without the word, which is not really the way it is in the Greek at all. The word, in the first mention of the expression, has the article that with it, and it's a reference, of course, to the Bible. They don't obey the word. They don't accept the gospel. They are unbelievers. And yet they can be won without a word, not without the Bible or without the gospel, but without a word, without the women having to preach at them, without speaking at them, without shoving the gospel down their throat the whole time. So he says, even though they are rebellious against the gospel, they can nevertheless be won without your having to thump, thump, thump into their ear holes the whole time, and they can be won when they see your behavior, verse 2, your reverent and chaste behavior. So he's encouraging these women to be submissive and to not make matters worse by coming to their antagonistic husbands and ramming the gospel down their throat with great gusto. He says, if you behave yourself correctly, that will probably be the best way of winning them over and getting them to be more reasonable in their assessment of you. He likewise tells them that they're not to try to win their husbands by over-lavish decoration of themselves. Not that there's anything wrong with wives looking nice. Nothing to be proud of in looking like something a cat dragged in. But he says there's something more important. So he says, let yours be the outward adorning in verse 3. Not with all this overdressing and all the rest of it, he says, but in verse 4, rather with the hidden person of the heart, the imperishable jewel of a gentle and a quiet spirit. And that's very precious in God's sight. And he says, if you concentrate on developing this sort of character, then the chances are that your husband is going to be much more inclined to respect your views and hopefully in due course listen to what you've got to say. He gives an example from the holy women of old, and by holy women he doesn't mean women that went around sprinkled with holy water or dressed up in some fancy regalia, but those women of old who were God's women, those who were set apart. And he said even those set a good example. He quotes Sarah, for example. And he says of Sarah in verse 6 that she obeyed Abraham and called him Lord, which sounds a bit rough on our ears, but we must remember, of course, that that is a reasonably common sort of a term by which people address others that they respect. You find it used quite frequently as people spoke to Jesus, and right through the East you find it's fairly common to have this title of respect. But it doesn't mean Lord and Master in the sense that we might sometimes imagine. But obviously Sarah gave Abraham respect, and it said that she obeyed, which means, if you read the story, that when he asked her to go and to prepare a meal for some visitors, she went and did it. So obeyed is a fairly tough sort of a word there. If you look up the story, it's interesting to see that so far from using the word that Sarah obeyed Abraham, there is a place where God says to Abraham, you obey Sarah. Whatever your wife tells you to do, do it, he says in one place. So that just sort of balances out the story a little bit. But the point he's saying is this. You have examples that the wife is to be cooperative, and he says you're not going to gain anything by taking up the cudgels against your husband and trying to rebel against him. He says if you behave in this fashion, then who knows, you might be able to win him for Christ. The last part of verse 6, you are now her children if you do right, and let nothing terrify you. Notice those words there, let nothing terrify you. These women were terrified of their husbands. He's obviously not talking about Christian wives and Christian husbands. He's talking about Christian wives who are dead scared of their non-Christian husbands. So these women are scared of their husbands, but he says, if you follow the advice I'm giving you, then who knows, he said, they may be won. And certainly you won't have so much cause to be terrified. So there you have the three situations. And in each case, it's an unpleasant situation. You can't use these verses to justify cruelty by the state against citizens. You can't use them to justify domination of slaves by their masters, nor can you use it to justify domination of wives by their husbands. He's not talking about that. He's talking about the other way around, how Christians are to act when they find themselves in unpleasant situations, be it the citizen walked over by the state, the slave walked over by his master, or the wife walked over by her husband. I don't think Christian husbands can use verses 1 to 6 and apply them to themselves or to their marriage. In fact, if Christian husbands want to know what they're to do, they don't look at those verses at all. They look at the next verse, because in verse 7, Peter specifically addresses Christian husbands. So this is the bit for them. And it's entirely different from what you get in the previous 6 verses. Christian husbands, he says, you husbands, live considerately with your wives. Now the previous lot in verse 6, they were husbands who had their wives terrified. But now Christian husbands don't live like that. Christian husbands in verse 7 live considerately with their wives. They bestow honour. They don't treat them as if they can walk all over them. They bestow honour upon the woman as the weaker sex. Weaker, of course, in the sense of weaker physically. Although I did see on the telly the other night where there's some of these ladies that are going in for this muscle business, you know, this bodybuilding and getting all the sinews and the muscles standing out. Look pretty revolting, actually, I thought. I'd sooner leave them the way they were. But here he says you bestow honour on the woman. You don't treat her as something just around the house. You are joint heirs. Get the word again? Joint heirs. Equality. That's what the expression means. Joint heirs means you are heirs together, equally heirs of the grace of God. Now, of course, in the society that God has constructed, way from the beginning of time, from the creation of humanity, God has placed within society certain responsibilities, and there's no sense women trying to be the same as men, nor men trying to be the same as women. There are certain things women can do that men can't do, and vice versa, and we've been made differently because we have different functions. But when it comes to a husband and wife living together, and both are Christians, this whole idea of submission and domination, I don't think should ever even arise. If we're following this verse 7 through, we meaning husbands, if we're following that through, this whole question of who's boss and who's submissive wouldn't occur. Now, ultimately, responsibility rests with the husband, and this is the way God has had it since the beginning. But responsibility is one thing, and domination is quite another thing. And it's wrong, in my view. The husbands are to live considerately with their wives. They are to give honor to their wives. They are joint heirs with their wives. And what's the purpose, he says? So that your prayers may not be hindered. If there's tension between husband and wife, and if the husband is not if the Christian husband is not behaving as in verse 7, but rather behaving as the non-Christian in verses 1 to 6, then there's going to be tension. There's going to be fear. There's going to be lack of trust. And where there's tension, well, then you're not going to get a very happy prayer life together. So if there is this right relationship as you have in verse 7, then he says your prayers won't be hindered. The question arises, of course, how much do husbands and wives pray together? I read a report recently in an American Christian magazine, or it was an Australian magazine actually, quoting a report from America, where a survey had been done around one of the states of America across the families within the church, or churches. And the amazing statistic they came up with was that those houses where there was some sort of family reading or family prayers or any sort of get-together within the family where the Bible was read and God was addressed, something Christian in that form, was something, I can't remember the exact figure, but I think it was 8%. It was definitely less than 10%. And the number of houses where the husband and wife ever had any prayer together was 3%. And we wonder why we've got troubles. You wonder sometimes what Christian people are doing. And if Christian husbands and wives have this lack of communion, lack of understanding, or even praying together or doing things together, well, no wonder sooner or later things start to get a little bit tense. One of the main reasons for the domestic harmony is that the prayers of the husband and wife together might be answered. 1 Peter 3:7. So much for the family. And then verses 8 to 12 speak largely about the church. Verse 8, finally have unity of spirit, sympathy and love of the brethren. So love of the brethren now talks about the relationships within the church. Tender heart, humble mind, verse 9, don't return evil for evil or reviling for reviling. And once again, sometimes you get rough treatment in the church. But he says we must always learn to bless. Once again, to this you have been called. Verse 10, he gets a number of quotations in here. He who would love life and see good days, let him keep his tongue from evil and his lips from speaking guile. Let him turn away from evil and do right. Let him seek peace and pursue it. For the eyes of the Lord are upon the righteous and his ears are open. Once again, you see the right attitude of Christians is one of the prerequisites for prayer. If we want our prayers to be answered, then we have to learn something about getting along with people. And if there's friction in the house, or if there is, as we have here in verses 10 and 11, a lack of turning away from evil, well, we can't expect God's ears to be open to our prayers because the face of the Lord is against those who do evil, he says in verse 12. Well, there are some of the basic considerations that Christians have in their relationships. In each of those four cases, we find there is tension, there is friction, and there are Christians who are suffering when they haven't done wrong. But in each case, we are to turn the other cheek, and we are not to be up on our back legs defending our own rights. We are to take the example of Christ, who when he was reviled, reviled not again. We come now to chapter 3, verse 13. And from here through to the end of chapter 4 is the main section that deals with suffering for righteousness' sake. I'm going to finish tonight at chapter 3, which is a rather unfortunate place to finish because the argument again goes right through without any break between the end of chapter 3 and the beginning of chapter 4. We've got to stop somewhere, so that's where we'll stop. suffering for Christ's sake, or suffering for righteousness' sake. Let us not deceive ourselves here as Christians. Sometimes we suffer, and we think we're suffering because we're Christians, but we're possibly suffering because we're a bit obnoxious. Sometimes Christians can be very silly in the way they behave and create unnecessary difficulties for themselves and then deceive themselves that they're suffering for righteousness' sake. Suffering for righteousness' sake, I believe, has something to do with our standing firm for God, and even when it means that people won't accept the gospel and won't accept Christ and oppose us for our beliefs, we will still stand firm for the sake of Christ, suffering for doing what is right, suffering for Christ's sake, suffering for righteousness' sake. Now, if we are living properly as Christians, Peter says in verse 13, where he asks the question, who is there to harm you if you are zealous for what is right? When he says, who is there to harm you, he's not referring here to physical harm, because in the next verse he says, it's quite obvious that you're going to suffer some sort of physical harm, and he's already mentioned it two or three times in the verses we've read tonight where people did suffer physical harm. But what he's saying here is that persecution cannot really harm those who are eager to please God, because they will always turn it to good, and so it can't harm them. He's already given us a few quotes. Don't return evil for evil. Don't return reviling for reviling. On the contrary, bless. So it can't harm you, he says, because when they revile you, you bless. So it hasn't harmed you. It's done you good, because you've blessed. So he says, if you live the way I'm outlining to you, the real person, the real you, it can't really harm you, because you'll always turn it to good. This is not a bad thought, is it? I think that's the positive attitude Christians should have. Even these things that we don't welcome, we don't like, turning them to good. And ultimately, they do us no harm. And I think the more we do that, the tougher hides we get. And I think Christians need to foster the attitude of developing thick skins. Too many thin-skinned creatures around the place, too many thin-skinned Christians around the place who get offended at nothing. You say they get very easily harmed. As soon as something, they get upset over things, and the next minute they're not talking to somebody over there, and then they're murmuring against somebody else, and they haven't learned what it is to turn these things to good. And the more they learn how to turn these things to good, the less they'll be bothered over those pinpricking things. Who is there to harm you if you really are zealous for what is right? But when it comes to physical harm, he leaves them in no doubt, verse 14, that the chances are they are going to suffer. And I would imagine that many people who read this letter were probably thrown to the lions, executed by the government, because the great persecution of Nero was just about to burst upon them in all its fury. He's going to talk more about that later in chapter 4, but let us move on in chapter 3. Have no fear of them, nor be troubled, but, verse 15, in your hearts reverence Christ as Lord. Now that's the first thing. You must have a right attitude towards Christ, a right attitude of reverence towards God. Secondly, always be prepared to make a defense to anyone who calls you to account for the hope that is in you. Yet do it with gentleness and reverence. So we must have a right attitude towards our fellow man. We must be prepared to make a defense when these accusations come, and if they want to know why we believe what we believe, we've got to be able to tell them. But he says, do it with gentleness and reverence. Gentleness, have a right attitude towards man. Reverence, have a right attitude towards God. And Peter knew what he was talking about, because you know the occasion when he was asked a question relevant to this. He was waiting in the courtyard at the high priest's house. Aha, they said, you're one of his followers. And we know that Peter answered in a way that showed he wasn't very gentle. In fact, I think he cursed the people that asked him the questions. So he wasn't gentle to them, and he certainly didn't reverence Christ. In fact, he denied him. And in verse 16, his own conscience was damaged, and you know he went out and wept. So Peter has learnt his lesson, and he's passing it on to us. Have a right attitude to man, have reverence towards God, and verse 16, keep your own conscience clear, so that when you are abused, those who revile your good behavior in Christ may be put to shame. I'm sure all of us at times don't have a clear conscience when we've been asked something about our Christian belief, and And the old weakness of the flesh is still there. And later, like Peter, we go away and weep, if not actually, at least figuratively. Our conscience tells us that we have not performed loyally to our master. And so there's a very simple little section dealing with our responsibility to be witnesses for Jesus Christ with gentleness, reverence, and a good conscience. Verse 17, it is better to suffer for doing right, if that should be God's will, than for doing wrong. For Christ also died for us. Here again you have the example of Christ. This is about the third time we've met it now. Christ is always the example of suffering for righteousness' sake. Christ also died for sins once for all, the righteous for the unrighteous, that he might bring us to God, being put to death in the flesh, but made alive in the spirit, in which he went and preached to the spirits in prison, who formerly did not obey when God's patience waited in the days of Noah during the building of the ark, in which a few, that is, eight persons, were saved through water. We'll just stop there for a moment. These are very famous verses, aren't they? Very difficult verses, and we look at them and we think, goodness me, what's all this going on, preaching to the spirits in prison? First of all, it refers to Christ being put to death in the flesh but made alive in the spirit. Now that seems to me to be fairly straightforward. It's a reference to the fact that Christ died, and then of course he entered fuller life, the resurrection, the glory of Jesus Christ. But what about these spirits in prison? And what about the preaching to them? Part of our problem, I believe, is because whenever we see the word preach, we think of preach in the sense of getting a response. Billy Graham preached and 45 people responded to the appeal. But that is not at all the meaning of the word preach here. It's the same word that elsewhere is translated proclaim or announce. And that, I believe, is what is being spoken of here. Christ, having died and then victoriously entered new life, went and proclaimed his victory to the imprisoned evil spirits. We don't know how he did it or when he did it. I mean, we just don't have the details. All we have is these few verses to talk about it. But that appears to me to be the meaning. The spirits that are referred to, as it says here in verse 20, are those that led man in his rebellion against God. If you go back to the story of Noah and the chapter preceding the story of Noah, you have a reference there to the sons of God inciting mankind, coming into union with the daughters of men and rebelling against God. That's interpreted in various ways. I take it to mean that that is a reference to some sort of spirit beings with man's cooperation trying to produce a race of supermen. The chapter goes on to talk about there being giants in the land and all the rest, and they were going to establish a super race, and of course they rebelled against God and God wiped them out in the flood. This reference here to the spirits that rebelled in the time of Noah is referred to again in 2 Peter and in the Epistle of Jude. Now that, of course, is not watertight. That's open to debate as to whether that interpretation I've given you is correct. But it strikes me as being entirely in keeping with the context of this chapter. So what I would say happened is this. Christ died in the flesh, put to death in the flesh, crucified. And yet we know that he conquered death, conquered Satan, conquered evil, conquered sin. Having achieved that triumph, he then proclaimed his victory to those imprisoned, rebellious, evil spirits as an assurance to them that their judgment was certain. There are a number of times in the New Testament where you find the resurrection of Jesus Christ spoken of as an assurance of future judgment. Jesus did so in John chapter 16, where he talked about the Spirit bringing conviction concerning sin and righteousness and judgment. He talked about then he was going to his Father and the prince of this world is conquered. Again, the context there is of Christ conquering Satan, ascending to his Father, and this makes judgment inevitable. You come to Paul and you find the same thing in Acts chapter 17. God commands all men everywhere to repent because he has appointed a day in which he will judge the world in righteousness, and he has given assurance by raising Jesus Christ from the dead. God is going to judge the world by Jesus Christ, and he has given assurance through the resurrection. Peter, I believe, is saying the same. The resurrection of Jesus Christ is an assurance of judgment. Jesus said it, Paul said it, Peter said it. And it fits with the context of persecuted Christians. Here are people who are suffering, and they're inclined to get downhearted. Peter says to them, you are on the winning side. Don't get downhearted, because Christ has triumphed, and you through him also triumph. And just as the doom of the evil rebellious spirits in the past is sealed through Christ's resurrection, so the doom of your persecutors is sealed through Christ's resurrection. So don't fear them. Reverence in your heart Christ as Lord, and realize that if you suffer for righteousness' sake, nobody can really harm you, and ultimately you will enjoy the fullness of life which Jesus Christ has made available. He has conquered sin, death, and Satan, and through him you too can be assured of the ultimate conquest of sin, death, and Satan. Now that, I believe, is the meaning of those few words. He finishes in verse 20 by talking about people being saved through water, and obviously the story of Noah and the ark is a good Old Testament illustration of salvation. And Peter now goes on to give a good New Testament illustration of salvation, and that is baptism. It corresponds to this, he says. One is in the Old Testament, this other one's New Testament. Both of them are pictures of what salvation is. He goes on in verse 21 to say that it's not literally the water which saves you. It's not the removal of dirt, but it's the inner working. It's the appeal to God of a clear conscience. So baptism has its value, but he says it's not the water that's going to wash away the stains. It symbolizes something inward. It's not the removal of dirt from the body, but it's an appeal to God for a clear conscience through the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And once again, you have that coming through. And so baptism, as we all know, is this death identified with Christ and life identified with Christ. And again, I would suggest that that bears out the interpretation that I've suggested to you over those previous difficult verses. And so Christ has gone into heaven and is at the right hand of God, and the angels, authorities and powers are all subject to him. And he goes on in chapter 4 then to develop this idea and to build further upon the ideas that I've already outlined of death and then resurrection, conquest of sin and Satan and rebellious spirits, and life through Jesus Christ, both now and with the assurance of fuller life in the future. Well, there it is. Suffering for righteousness' sake, and right through this whole section tonight, the consistent theme. Don't retaliate. But realize that no matter what happens, you are Christ's, and Christ is God's. And through him, you will triumph just as he triumphed.